we had very uproarious kirtan. Sometimes there were only three or four or five of us there, but people joined in. And on one occasion, on the lower level, there was some kind of a celebration going on. I remember we had a big kirtan, and there were maybe 100 people there. And it was one of those things where everybody just sort of let it all hang out, so to speak. Started to dance and chant, and it became a real event. Everyone participated, everyone chanted, and everyone danced, and became sort of lost in the ecstasy of kirtan. It was a very special night. So that was a regular thing, and it came to pass that through Gurudas, who met a boy named Nigel Samuel. I think he's from the Samuel jewelry chain, right? Anyway, he owned this building, and he was quite wealthy. So he let us have a building in Betterton Street, which is in Covent Garden. And for about 3 months, that was only maybe a few hundred yards from this arts lab in Drury Lane. So we were able to use the whole building. And Prabhupada's letters would come regularly and inspire us to do things. So once we had that place, we decided to call together all the people we knew into one place and make an appeal to have a temple. So we'd written to Prabhupada and asked him to send a tape so that we could play a cassette tape of his speaking and everyone would be able to hear. So he sent out an invitation, a fairly fancy invitation, and it was written with a kind of tongue-in-cheek mode, and it said, guess who's coming to dinner? And there was a big list of people, including some members of Parliament, and the Queen, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, and the Beatles, and so on. And it said, guess who's coming to dinner? Maybe nobody, but here's who's invited. And then we gave the list. And somehow it captured their imagination, and a lot of people showed up, thinking that some of these other people might be there. It had the letterhead of ISKCON with a picture of Radha and Krishna in a lotus on it, and Jimuna was our cook, and we hired some stainless steel cutlery silverware to serve everything out in, and there were no chairs. It was just a burlap floor, just a big bare room about this size, a little bit bigger maybe. And the tape from Srila Prabhupada had come just a few days before. So when that came, we felt confident that even though we had no qualifications to talk to members of Parliament and some of the VIPs that came, that we would succeed. Do you want to talk about that a little that night? I'll just say what I can remember. Maybe Shamsunar will pick up on this. But we prepared little speeches, and we listened to Prabhupada's talk ahead of time. He chanted Hare Krishna mantra at the beginning of the tape, and then we talked for about 15 minutes. So I remember one member of Parliament who came was Tom Driver. He was a fairly prominent MP at the time. He'd written some books. He was a literateur of sorts, and he was the MP for Barking. Had the big hall named after him out there somewhere, the Tom Driver Hall. And he'd helped us actually get our premises in Berry Place later on. So he came, and with very great difficulty sat cross-legged on this burlap floor, probably in his 60s then. And a few other people of note came. Most of them were sort of dressed semi-formally. And so we gave presentations. I remember you gave something. We had a board when we were tracing the history of ISKCON, and how we had grown, where we had temples, what countries we were in, what our philosophy was. So the three of us, Gurudas and Shamsunar, stood up and tried to give a little impression of what Krishna consciousness was about, and then we played the tape of Prabhupada, and he had a very deep resounding voice. And, my dear ladies and gentlemen, and started off with a little kirtan, and then he proceeded to explain what he was doing and why he was here. And he said actually we can live under a tree. It does not matter. We're in the renounced order of life, but in order for nice ladies and gentlemen like you to have a place to sit down comfortably and hear, we require a proper premises. So when we heard that, we felt very relieved because he was older than most of the people there, and he had a very, very distinguished sounding voice, and kind of aged compared to what we sounded like. So we actually felt very secure. We felt sheltered by Prabhupada, and that whatever he said was really penetrating and making people more respectful. And it actually was the case, because here they were in this bare room, in there, many of them wearing suits and ties, sitting on the floor, listening to a bunch of Americans that they'd never seen before in strange clothes with strange markings on their foreheads. And when Prabhupada spoke, it changed the whole environment. And you could see that people were listening, and the whole mood was a lot more serious. So that was the appeal, that we should have a proper place, a bigger place, a suitable premises. And of course we read a little from Bhagavad Gita and other books and explained our philosophy. And at the end, we had the ability of Jamuna, who had cooked all day and some very nice catering, silver catering equipment and eating utensils. So I don't think anybody was dissatisfied, even though it was not all what they'd expected, because the prasadam was excellent, and the way it was served was also very excellent. So I think maybe there was a guy named Miles from the International Times, who was one of our people who connected us with Tom Dreiberg and a few other semi-notable people who were all kind of surprised to see each other there, in a way, in that kind of a setting. But that was our first attempt. That was maybe in November, I think. We had arrived in September, August and September. And that was sort of a beginning of, in this country, it was seemed to be, to us, more of a matter of knowing the right people and knowing what to do. So we tried to work through a network of people who were friends, who were connected in some kind of a network, and in that way to get a little foothold in the beginning. the old voice system.
In fact, I think what the thing was through all these times was the constant emphasis that we placed on humor. We were so fortunate to be with Prabhupada so much before we came to England, and Prabhupada was always in a jolly mood, and this infected us. And we knew that things weren't going right if we weren't laughing about it. Every day we would get together after our separate endeavors for the day and exchange the humorous incidents that had happened to each of us. We had so much fun putting this thing together. That's all I remember, is the amazing amount of laughter and jokes that we were constantly exchanging. And I think that's, you know, Prabhupada was always, when he was spreading Krishna consciousness and happiest, he was always joking too. This is one of the symptoms of being Krishna conscious, that you're in a comic mood almost. And someone asked me yesterday, and they said, "Yeah, I don't pretend to be a preacher or a spiritual master or a guru of any kind. I remember some of the things Prabhupada said." This person asked me, "How do you know, or what is the best thing to remind you that Krishna is the controller?" Yeah, Krishna is the controller of everything. And I thought for a moment of my own experiences with Prabhupada. And whenever I was strongest feeling that Krishna was the controller was when I had so much to do that I couldn't possibly manage it all. And I think that was part of the key to our success here as well. But Prabhupada heaped this huge responsibility on us. And we always had much more than we could possibly handle. So we knew we weren't doing anything. Krishna was controlling everything. However it turned out, good or bad or indifferent, we had nothing to do with it. It was Krishna gradually doing everything. It took a long time to get a foothold, a very long time. People of England are a bit resistant to something like this, as they were in those times. So humor, I think, and the adventure, I remember, the feeling as a young man that I was having more fun and experiencing more adventure than anything, any other kind of activity I could be doing. I mean, every day was a total risk. We did things that I would never do now. I mean, there was no limit. We were fearless. Because we had each other's strength, too, and we had Prabhupada's constant strength. Even he would call up on the telephone sometimes, and we'd all gather around, take turns talking to him in San Francisco or Los Angeles, telling him, and he'd always push. Well, hurry up, what are you guys doing? Come on. And we told him that our mutual feeling was that we should have a center close into the heart of London. Because of the living conditions as householders, we all had to live in various suburbs and quite often far away from each other. You'd be out in Clapham and I'd be in Balham and Gurdas would be up in Golders Green and, you know, we had trouble communicating even. And so it dawned upon us that if we were going to be effective at all, that we should be in the center of London, right in the heart. And wait and work towards some very nice facility right in the heart of London, as opposed to setting up a storefront somewhere in Golders Green. Well, this took a long time, and Prabhupada, you know, he encouraged us that way. Yes, he said we should have a place where the gentlemen and gentlewomen of England can come and feel at home and listen to the philosophy. The emphasis was always on philosophy, he told us. And when ultimately we got our place, Berry Place, just near the British Museum, he was just very, very happy about that. We had a place a half a block from Oxford Street, a block from the British Museum. Do you remember the first time when Prabhupada finally arrived and we were bringing him into London? We took him on a little tour around through town. He had never, of course, been to London, but he'd been reading since childhood about London. And the first thing he saw was, he said, Prabhupada, these are the Houses of Parliament. Oh, they're not so big. Many homes in Calcutta are larger. And he saw the River Thames, and he says, this is but a small stream. And the Big Ben, a very small clock. He wasn't impressed. But I remember one of the things that Prabhupada made us work harder is that Prabhupada set us deadlines. Do you remember those, Mukunda? We had to have everything ready by Janmashtami of such and such a year or whatever. And it just, we became overwhelmed with work. Well, you're all devotees, you know what that's like. You have to get everything ready for a certain time and place. But for Prabhupada's arrival, that put it into a real heavy mode. And fortunately, we were able to recruit a few young English devotees, most of whom are not here or other places. Anjaya is still here. In the early days, Bajali. What is overwhelming about the whole thing for me is I've been gone for 20 more than 20 years from Krishna consciousness, is to see that all of you young people, although only a very small percentage of you ever even saw Prabhupada, have maintained the perfect level of Krishna consciousness that he planted here. And you're all so highly elevated and angelic. It makes me speechless to see how the potency of Prabhupada's movement has carried on so nicely. The temple, everything, it's just beyond what we could have even imagined in those times.
One of the things we as Shyamsundar was saying, had to do was to do very difficult things that we wouldn't ordinarily do. And this idea of establishing a temple in the center of London was so difficult that after a while we sort of became detached from it, you know, and you're trying to do something sometimes and you just think, well, it's up to Krishna now. It actually became like that. We had piles and piles of particulars, of buildings, you know, the details from different estate agents, where they were located, how many square feet, you know, all the details that I say with them. So we had piles and piles, and every time we tried to get a building, we didn't have enough money. They needed it all right away. We didn't have a guarantor, didn't have enough money in the bank. We weren't an established or registered institution. So it was almost like going nowhere for months and months and months. It almost took a whole year. And it was just the letters that were coming from Prabhupada that were sustaining the effort. Sometimes we'd be walking the streets of central London, writing down the details on the side of a building that would say for let or for sale, and we'd write down the name of the state agent. We'd come back with a list of 10 or 20 and we'd write them or ring them, and then they would send all these things, and when we'd apply, and they'd just say, sorry, you know, you're a nobody, we can't help you. And they all wanted just the cash, you know, just pay for the whole thing and get a bank loan. We had no ability whatever to do anything like that. So, you want to tell about that?
We were still getting nowhere, and we had to leave Betterton Street. We'd been given notice. The Black Power people had moved in on the floor above us. What was the guy's name? Michael X and his crew, and they were gradually encroaching on our floor. And the owner of the building had given us kind of notice that you guys have to leave here soon. So we didn't know what we were going to do. And one day in the bank, a man ran into Gurdas and said, "Say, you wouldn't happen to know Sam Spearster, would you? I don't know, he's a Hare Krishna." And this guy, turns out he was an old friend of mine from San Francisco who had moved to London and had become an estate agent here. And we were talking with him, and he said that he knew of a building right on just off New Oxford Street. And remember, the ownership was a little hazy. Nobody really knew who owned it, but his firm was taking £35 a week, something, rent off for it, if they could rent it. So we immediately grabbed it. £35 a week. And I believe in later years, didn't it turn out that the ownership went into litigation or something and we didn't have to pay any rent? So, yeah, I don't know whoever, if that was ever settled or not, but at any rate, as soon as we rented the Berry Place, we began, we saw that it was going to be too small to contain many people, and that it was too confining, and we really wanted to make a nice presentation because it was right in the heart of London. We wanted people to step off the street, New Oxford Street, on their way to the British Museum, or we were across the street from the Theosophical Society, and walk in and have a very nice place. So we began a massive program of reconstruction. We tore out the ceiling, and so we had a two-story high temple room. And I had imported some redwood from California, which is a very beautiful wood. And we actually spent months building this place. Around Mukunda, Gurdas, girls, getting donations, £5 here, £10 there, to keep the work going to make the place proper so that when Prabhupada came, he'd be very proud of us. There was, in those days, also kind of a competition between the God brothers starting various temples around the world, a friendly competition. But our main kind of competitor was Karanda in Los Angeles, because he kept proclaiming LA is going to be the world capital. London is going to be the world capital of this kind. So we were constantly competing to try to make Prabhupada's place in London better than the place in Los Angeles. So after several months of this intensive construction work, one day, in through the door walks Mr. Savage and Mr. Black. They're the building inspectors. Oh, what have we got here? You blokes wouldn't have a permit, would you? No, we don't have any permits. So. Actually, after their inspection, they were pretty nice about it, but Dickinson and Maine, you know, Savage and Black, they were actually pretty nice about the whole thing. After their inspection, they said, well, you know, actually this is stronger than the code. It's built this place better than the code, but you have to have a permit. So they retroactively gave us the permit. That's a nice problem. I remember another funny incident. Remember those big iron steel beams we had to put into that ring? They were so large we had to bring them in with cranes, with big trucks. Mick Jagger donated the money for it. We had to take out the whole front of Jerry Place, the windows and the bricks and everything, to get these two big beams in a single piece. And it wound up tying traffic up all over London the whole day. Constantly we would report our updates. Almost daily, at least weekly. Each of us individually, or sometimes in group letters. And boom, right back would come a letter with some more suggestions. Prabhupada actually took the management of the English yatra in hand, far away, and directed it from afar. He was interested in every detail of everything we did. And then he said, I remember, Mukunda, you probably do too, he finally said, I think they won the telephone. I am coming. We just set a date. We weren't ready. He said, can you take it from there? Remember what happened?
When this premises was told to be available, it was a very strange situation, because we went to him and he said, just move in. And what about planning permission, what about rent? Just move in. You know, occupancy is 9/10 of the law. Just move in. So we went to some estate agents that were associated with him. He was a nominal owner. And they were, you know, at least a little weak or something. No, you don't need it. No, just move in. Move in. Yeah. So just give us the money, you know. I think they wanted like three months rent in advance, which was something near to about 500 pounds. So we insisted, and then we contacted the solicitors of the then Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, and then were Goodman and Derrick, the Goodman, Derrick and Company. And then they had their solicitors, Sean Jay, the Olympic Central, the British team. Anyway, they made some kind of a deal between these two solicitors where we were going to be there, sort of an unnamed group of people were going to be in there for a period of time. A very strange arrangement. Couldn't do the lease. And ultimately, I think the building belonged to what was then the Ministry of Public Works and Building and Public Works. So we just did it. We just moved in, and it was this very low price. Yeah. Right near the British Library. So when we notified Prabhupada, he was very encouraged. Oh, yes, you should take it right away, because we weren't sure. It was a little risky, but we didn't have any money. So I asked Prabhupada, this was either a phone call or a telegram or something, that, you know, we need 500 pounds or we just can't get the place. But they insisted that we have this money. So he said, yes, I will immediately wire the money to you, don't worry, and he'd send us the money. That was how we paid for it, money out of his book account or something. And then they wanted a guarantor, didn't they? And I think that's when we asked George Harrison, and he wrote a letter on Apple letterhead saying, yeah, I know these people, they're rich, it's okay, no worries. And so they just, you know, it was in, we were in, and that was it. And then Prabhupada then that's when he was saying that he had to come. He gave us a date, and I think he landed in Germany and spent a week or so there in Berlin, and then he flew to London, and that was when he came. And by that time, we were well ensconced in there. We had we were actually staying out at John Lennon's when we came. We also rented an apartment on Baker Street. Yeah, when he came. when he came in, he'd come from Germany, and it had been raining, and it happened at a time when the Radhakrishnan Temple record was very popular. It was selling 70,000 copies a day or something. So they arranged this VIP room where Prabhupada would land, come down a ramp on the airline, walk across the tarmac, and then right into the room through some sliding glass doors. So he didn't have to undergo any formalities with immigration. Just someone came out and wrote down some numbers in his passport, and that was it. So when he came in, I think it was Shyam Sundar and someone else ran out to greet him. And if I remember, it was Hayagriva and Purushottam who were with Prabhupada coming off the plane. And so they ran out and offered their dandavats. And of course, there was a lot of puddles of water out there in the tarmac. I remember you got up and you're all full of jet fuel and water mixed with dirt and pebbles. And there was a British policeman with the checkered hat accompanying Prabhupada. And he made this amazing expression as he watched you get up. Completely just doing his job. Anyway, he ushered Prabhupada into the room. And then there was a great kirtan there in that room. There were vasas, and Prabhupada sat on a little table and led a kirtan. And after the kirtan, everyone was dancing, and many devotees had never seen Prabhupada before. It was just six of us and a few who'd come from the States, and most of them were British devotees. And it was a very amazing scene, because there were tears in their eyes, and they'd never even laid eyes on Prabhupada before. But it was you could see that there was a great buildup of emotion, as he had appeared. And after the kirtan, everyone bowed down. I think you have a picture of that from the sun. I was just looking at it. Yeah, there's a picture of everyone bowing down from the Sun newspaper, the back page. So everyone bowed down, and as they were kind of getting up, there were a group of Fleet Street reporters that started to converge on Prabhupada. And these were the kind of wolves of Fleet Street that the Apple Company had invited to see the pop stars. I can probably find it. And so Prabhupada, they all kind of converged, and they were flashing away with their cameras. And they came up to Prabhupada, and they said, "Here it is. Oh, this is okay. This is right out in the tarmac. I've got to pass this around if it's okay. This is amazing. Funny picture. You can see the policeman. You can see Purushottam and Hayagriva. There's about six devotees, all in their white, bang down right out in the wet tarmac, and the bottom of the feet are all black. You can see it. happiness is Hare Krishna. It's the back page of the sun. So they all converged on Prabhupada, and very challengingly, one of them said, "Why have you come here?" And Prabhupada said, "I have come to teach you what you have all forgotten, and that is God." They all kind of stopped for a beat. And then after a kind of embarrassing silence, one of them said, "Well, then Prabhupada said, before they could say anything, "Some of you think God is dead, and some of you think there is no God, and some of you don't believe in anything." And then they all kind of stopped a little bit, and then Prabhupada talked some more, and then in a very timid way they started asking him things like, "Do you know about Billy Graham? How many countries have you been to? How many devotees do you have? How many temples do you have in this country?" So we were witnessing him really keeping this pack of, well, I shouldn't be so demeaning, but you know how they are. These are the real tough Fleet Street guys, the pack of wolves being kept at bay. That's what it kind of looked like, you know. Intellectually, Prabhupada had really taken charge. So they were taking a lot of pictures, and that was one of them. And then the next morning, someone brought Prabhupada a picture that was spread across two pages in a tabloid then called the Daily Sketch. And it had a picture of Prabhupada playing Kartals, and it was tilted kind of to one side with his eyes closed. And he looked at the picture and he said, "I was in too much ecstasy." And then he gave the picture to Purushottam. He said, "Have Jadarani make a painting of this immediately." And then she made this beautiful painting from this photograph. But it said, "Enter Abhicharande Bhaktivedanta Swami," in big letters right across the page, two pages. And there were some other articles too. It was all part of the Apple publicity campaign for the record, which was kind of peeking out at that moment. And I remember when Prabhupada first got to his room, he asked Shyamasundari, he said, "So this record, Hare Krishna record, how many is it selling?" And Shyamasundari said, "Well, Prabhupada, it sold 70,000 copies today." And Prabhupada, "Oh, very big business." It was amazing to ever see him light up like that, you know, smile so wide or look so impressed.
Usually after press conferences or arrival deals, later up in his room with his confidential devotees, he'd sit around and say, "Did you hear what I said to that guy? Did you hear what I said to that guy? Wasn't that funny? You know, he was the best. He was the best. He knew how to put any audience under his thumb. I mean, an aggressive audience or a timid audience, whatever. He could feel the pulse of whoever he was talking to and turn on the charm or turn on the anger, turn on the love, whatever it took. Hardly ever did I see anyone come into Prabhupada's presence and walk away not touched by it, changed by it, and quite often very radically. But the first 3 months, then we stayed at John Lennon's place, right? Because the temple was under construction still in Berry Place. We really put a lot of work into that place. It took months to build, and Prabhupada got very impatient walking around John Lennon's garden every day, not doing anything, not preaching much. We tried to get him some engagements, and there were a few here and there, you know, at Camden Town Hall and that type of thing. Oxford Town Hall, that was a great one. But for the most part, he stayed out there in kind of a semi-seclusion while we got the temple ready. Many incidents happened there as well with John Lennon. Not many, but some. They were quite notable. Lennon and Yoko at that time were recluses themselves. No one saw them very often, but our job, we exchanged our labor by being allowed to live there for doing some reconstruction on his house. And I don't know whether I should tell the story of the Yoko. Anyway, it was a rather demonic, depressing time to be staying in that place. And Prabhupada didn't really like it there all that much. The grounds were very beautiful, and the walks and so on were extremely pleasant, but Prabhupada was anxious to get out into the battlefield and start preaching. So he pushed us very hard to finish up the place, and we finally did. I think we made a grand... Did we have a grand opening there at the temple? Did we have some kind of a grand opening?
Yeah.
Do you remember anything about that? I don't remember.
What happened there was Prabhupada gave us a deadline, December 14th, I think it was, 1969. That was the day that everything had to be done, and everyone would have to be invited. D would have to be installed. All the construction work would have to be done. And Shyam Sundar and Tirthapad and others were working almost day and night. And I remember going in from Tittenhurst every day on a bus back and forth from London. You know, I was trying to raise enough money to keep them going, and they were all spending more than we had in the bank. So it was quite a struggle. So he gave us that deadline, and it was a photo finish because he wanted a canopy above the deity to be installed. The room was done with a very a maroon-colored, burgundy-colored carpet, very beautiful, and Shyam Sundar had made a roof with curved pieces of redwood that also looked very beautiful, and big beams. So the fateful day arrived, and it was the day to install the deities, and Prabhupada bathed them. And then we all went behind this big curtain to prepare for the installation. And the deities were there. And is that the day? The 14th of December? The fateful day. Yeah, that's the day. Without canopy. So we tried to install this canopy. I think you were back. No, you were. You were out. Because he'd been up all night. And Tamal Krishnamaraj and something like that. Tamal Krishnamaraj was there, Jamuna was there, and we were back there with Prabhupada, and there were people sitting in the other side of the curtain waiting for the curtains to open and see the deities installed with their canopy over them. So there were four pillars and a kind of square-shaped canopy. It was rectangular at the bottom, and it kind of pitched up to a point. Anyway, we couldn't get it to stay because they had been up for two or three days, and they didn't have some right fastening mechanism or something like that. So it was falling, and we kept trying, and it was falling. At one point, Prabhupada jumped up and held it up, and it was reminded everyone of Krishna holding Govardhan Hill, you know, with his little thing of left hand. So finally, Prabhupada said, we'll open it without the canopy. It doesn't matter. Don't just take it out. Yeah, they don't want a canopy. Just take it out. So then there's this canopy. It's about this long and about that wide and about that high from the bottom to the top. And I had to somehow get out. And I said, what do you mean take it out? I said, just take it out outside. And, okay, it was about 120 degrees Fahrenheit in there because we didn't have any ventilation. And it was just, water was just pouring over our heads. So I had somehow to get from behind the curtain, through the crowd, and out to the front door and put this out on the footpath somehow or other without being too conspicuous. Impossible. So, you know, I made the attempt. I had this canopy and I sort of, you know, got out the side to make it look like it was just part of what was supposed to be happening, and asked everyone to make a little walkway, and somehow got outside where it felt like it was about 0 degrees after being inside there, and placed it against the building inside the railing, ran along the building, and then as quick as I could I got back inside so we could get ready to open it up for the people to see. So that was an amazing event. When Prabhupada finally sat down to speak, everyone saw the deities. The very first thing he was saying was, now we have this place, we're very thankful, and we want all of you to know that it's too small. We must get a bigger place as soon as possible. And from that moment on, the quest to get a bigger premises, especially Bhaktivedanta Manor, was underway. And Prabhupada was never one to let anyone rest on their laurels. But from that day on, we were in too small of a place, and we had to get a bigger place for the devotees to live. So that was par for the course for Prabhupada. Never let us rest for a moment. He gave us this deadline. We got it open somehow or other, and then it wasn't big enough. We had to find another place.
At that time, one of the reasons Prabhupada liked to stay in London so much or in England was that we constantly brought intelligent prominent guests to discuss with him, have conversations with him, which were very enlivening to Prabhupada. And George Harrison would come from time to time. And one morning, Prabhupada, I went into Prabhupada's room and I said, I had to go to a dinner with George that night at a fellow named David Wynn's house, who was a famous sculptor at that time. He designed the New English Money and the bust of the Queen and all that. And Prabhupada says, oh, okay. He says, I want you to ask him to publish the Krishna book. And for that we need $10,000, I think it was, or £10,000. And the basis of our relationship with George up to that time had always been, we never ask him for anything, because everybody in the world is trying to ask George Harrison, every religious sect of every type is trying to ask him for something. So he immediately turns off when anybody asks him for anything. So our secret of success, I guess you would say, up to that time, is that we never asked George for anything. We waited. Waited, sometimes strategically, until he offered it. But I was under the gun that night. Prabhupada said, yes, tonight you will ask him to print the Krishna book. So I was really on pins and needles all night during this dinner, waiting to the right moment to ask George to do this, because I thought by doing so I would certainly turn him off and maybe we'd never see him again. But finally at one point in the dinner I said, George, Prabhupada has requested me to ask you if you will print the Krishna book. So many copies, I've forgotten how many it was. I bet it will cost £10,000. And George says, how much? £10,000. And George started to go, I could just see that look. And suddenly, the house, or the adjacent house, or that house, was struck by a bolt of lightning. This is a true story. And all the lights went out. For about 5 minutes, there wasn't a sound at the table. And the lights came back on, and George looked at me and says, well, after that, I guess there's nothing else I can do. So I was able to report good news in the morning to Prabhupada. And no, he waited up. Prabhupada waited up. He waited up at 1 o'clock in the morning or so before I got back. Yes, George will do it. Oh, he was so happy. Prabhupada always rewarded the efforts of his devotees. If his devotees, if he saw the sincere efforts of his devotees, he would always reward them. I couldn't believe it. That one day we got back from morning walk about 3-4 days after we opened Berry Place, the usual walk around Russell Square, and he tapped on the side of the building in front. He said, you shall erect a plaque here, and it shall say, this temple has been constructed by Shyamasundara Das Adhikari. Walked in. Imagine.
The wooden beams that run along the side were about maybe, 40 feet long?
And they had to go through the front of the building, right out into the middle of the street, on cranes, through windows. So yeah, Prabhupada asked us to erect this plaque. I think he said it should say, this temple was built by the hard labor of effort by Shyamasundara Das Adhikari. He put some kind of a plaque up. It wasn't a very appropriate plaque. It was, should have been done in bronze. It was sort of painted on. But where is it now? When Chefs Bay Avenue and Endell Street. Yeah. Yeah, we walked through that place. Prabhupada liked it very much, but when he heard the price, he said it was beyond our dreams. We couldn't do it because they wanted cash.
After a while, we got into it too. We got the little laughing. We laid more on guys like Don and Jaya.
Made them work harder. The other thing we were always trying to do is make Don and Jaya laugh. It was hard to get a smile on. He's getting jollier in his old age.
His mother said that his hair was rusty. That's why it's red. When letters would come from Prabhupada, they would cause sometimes a complete shift in our direction. I remember when we first started preaching, the only people we knew were relatives and friends of this family who rented the house to us. So almost exclusively we're going to different homes of members of the Indian community. So one weekend, we had three engagements a day for 3 days, and we hardly had any sleep. We were in gymnasiums and auditoriums and classrooms, just wherever we could get an engagement, any English school, whatever it was, we were there. Sometimes there were only 5 people present, but because Prabhupada had written this letter, we had to sort of, you know, make up for time lost, and we just kind of turned ourselves inside out. I remember it was just a big blur. That 3 days went by. We were hardly sleeping at all. But we wanted to fulfill the desire of reaching out to the English-speaking public.
Do you ever look into after we got popular with this record,
and then Prabhupada arrived? He wanted to go on some of the. We were on Top of the Pops, and we had concert series all over Europe. We had concerts. But we had an agent, had our own agent. And Prabhupada wanted to go on some. He went on some of these. And remember the television program we went on in Amsterdam? Maybe you can remember it better than I can. I only remember that we had to get on an airplane with the whole crew, and this was the Dutch equivalent of Top of the Pops. And Prabhupada was going to be on it, too. The smoke. I remember the smoke.
Yeah, this was something that came at sort of the more or less the height of when the Radhakrishna Temple album was popular. In the European charts, it was up in the top 10, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, in different countries. So this was something that was arranged rather hurriedly, and no one really inquired much about it to find out what it was. And one day we just found ourselves all getting on a KLM jet flying to Amsterdam to be on this teenage rock popular program. So we got we landed in the airport in Amsterdam, and then we were all taken in a van, and it was most of us, Shamsun and Gurdas and I, and all the girls, and maybe 10 or 12 other devotees, and Prabhupada himself. So when we got there, they had us wait in a waiting room. It was in a basement, and then this, you were there, weren't you? Yeah. There was no ventilation and no windows. So Prabhupada was getting very uncomfortable, and he said, ask them, at least they should get us, you know, a place where there's some windows, there's some ventilation. We asked, and they wouldn't do it. And Prabhupada was, you know, getting more and more discouraged as time went on. We couldn't get anybody to move us, so nobody would budge. They were just like, hey, what's wrong with you guys? What are you so temperamental for? So then we finally, you know, had to wait in the queue and get up to the studio. And we got up to the studio, there were all these lights and booms and machinery hanging from the ceiling, very high ceiling. And Prabhupada looked up at it, and we were all kind of clustered around, and he said, someday this will all be piled up just like so much garbage. Oh, all right. And then we moved forward a little bit, and there were these bleachers, this kind of stepped stairs where dance go-go dancers were performing, men and women. And Prabhupada was kind of watching his spectacle from behind, because they were the background of all the different acts. You know, like a bandstand, or a football game, which you could see through from the back. And Prabhupada looked at him, he looked at us, and he looked up at them, and he said, just see, they're not even symmetrical. They're all, you know, gyrating and wiggling, whatever they do. So then we were getting closer up, and it was time for the performance, and they had brought this big throne type of affair out for Prabhupada to sit on. And underneath it, they'd placed some kind of invisibly underneath a bowl of water with, I guess it was dry ice floating inside, so that smoke was just spewing out from all sides of this chair so that it looked like it was floating on a cloud. That was the effect that they wanted to achieve. The Prabhupada would sit in that chair and he would, you know, sort of preside over Govinda Madhi Purusham. It was the Hare Krishna mantra. Hare Krishna mantra. And that's right, and we would pantomime the words to it. So that was the setting. And what did Prabhupada do? I don't think he agreed to. Yeah, that's what I remember. We objected to that cloud affair. So we somehow or other got him to take it away. No, he didn't. Maybe not. Ah. I guess we tried, but they didn't do it.
which is what they wanted. Huh. Yeah. And it kind of left a little bad taste in our mouths. I guess we didn't see the show, which probably came out okay, but it sold a lot of records. And
you know what's funny? Today we got a royalty check. How many pounds? 200 pound royalty check.
The first Rathiatra car was built in Balaam, in a driveway, in a small, next to a small flat I was renting. So I built this cart about the size of the one that's out there, very large cart, using whatever materials I could find, which wasn't much in those days in terms of hardware and good solid boards and money and all. And Gurdas and Mukunda went out and got the permit for us to have this long parade down from Marble Arch down Oxford Street, wasn't it? And so the night before the Rathiatra, we thought, well, we've got to get it over there.
Went down Park Lane.
Park Lane, okay, Trafalgar Square. It was going to go that way. huge cart, and it had never been tested under fire, but we thought, well, we can push it. We got Kula Shekhar and a couple of the other devotees over. We could push it all the way from Balam to Marble Arch. And we got it out about 10 feet, and that was it. Everybody was poof. We couldn't budge that thing. But, oh, my God, it's getting daylight, you know. We got to get this thing into town. So we hooked it up to my old pickup, and a combination of pulling with the pickup and you guys pushing for hours and hours and hours across London, we got it across the bridge and right up to Marble Arch, just in time for the start of the Rath Yatra. It was great. Oh, fantastic. We're saved. Thousands of people showed up. And we started out, we went about 100 meters. And the whole thing was the right wheel of traffic all over London for miles. That was the first stop, yeah. So everyone got engaged in dismantling it. The whole car had fallen apart. How they came back? They were already standard fixtures in the other temples in the United States, so it was expected that we would have them here also. We asked Prabhupada, I'm sure, if they wanted Jagannath. I carved them. And I understand they're the same ones that I carved. In the wharf area down by the docks, East London, where they were dismantling some barges, very large pieces of wood. Anybody have any other ideas? Anything you want to try to remember? Yeah, that's a great story. You know that story. You were the one that was in charge of that.
Actually, just to back up a little bit, when Mr. Savage and Mr. Black came and objected, Shamsunder went to another man named Mr. Wallace, who was their supervisor at the Ministry of Public Building and Works, and he pleaded with them on the plea that we were, true plea, that we were getting so many young people to give up drug habits. And if I think you told me this, he said, if your own son was drug habituated and you got off drugs, wouldn't you think that was the organization that did that? And he gradually softened up, and that was the basis upon which we were able to go forward at Berry Place. So one neighbor, yeah, he used to complain all the time at Berry Place. He was in the basement flat right next door to the temple. He was constantly bothering us, and he influenced another neighbor to initiate a petition to get everyone to sign. So one day we decided to have a meeting. This Mr. Wallace was the man who kind of moderated the whole meeting. So the man down below, his name was Mr. French, sat up there in the room with the lawyer of the absentee landlord, John Jay, and myself and Gurdas. I think you were there. Were you first? Yeah. So this is going to be a very placid conversation to discuss the noise question, the noise problem. And this man was complaining that the noise was so loud in the temple that it caused his wife to have heart palpitations, and it was a real life-threatening situation. So that was the basis upon which the whole discussion was taking place. Was it really noisy? And we'd gone to this great trouble to soundproof everything with insulation that was 6 or 7 inches thick and redwood boards and everything. So time finally came to test it. But before that happened, when I was trying to explain what we were doing, Mr. French became a little irate. And he used to sell vegetables in Covent Garden, and he had a bit of a drinking problem himself. So maybe he was a little hungover from the night before, but at one point when I was talking, he just jumped up and said, "He's a fast talker, he is!" And he lunged towards the door to throw it open, and as would happen only in a Hare Krishna temple, the whole knob came out, and he almost fell over backwards. He took about five-step backwards and just barely caught his balance and started to charge out the door. And Mr. Wallace said, "Wait, Mr. French, stop. Now let's not get so hot under the collar."
Don't bolt in the crunch.
Don't bolt in the crunch. Sit down. Let's not get so hot under the collar. Let's discuss this now. And so he had to sit down. He was fuming. And finally he said, "All right, let's go and let's test this out and see if it, you know, really, it's really that as loud as you say it is." So we all went in a little procession down the stairs. And I was in charge of the kirtan. And I kind of rushed down ahead of everyone. Where some devotees were in the temple playing kirtan. And I said, "Now just play a normal amount. But when we go next door, play soft. When we come..." Do we? Something like that. The idea was that when everyone went into Mr. French's apartment, they'd play almost inaudibly, and then when they'd come back into the temple to hear how they were really playing, the volume went back up, you know, about 20 decibels. So this little procession from the temple down to Mr. French's apartment went back and forth a few times. Oh, right. Right, because you wouldn't hear it. There was a passageway between the temple and this house in part of the way. And they'd come in and open the door, and it was boom, boom, boom. Very carefully orchestrated. And so we all got back up into the office and sat down and said, "Well, Mr. French, you know, it appears to be that it's not as loud as you say it is." And he was just turning every color from red to purple to blue. And you could see the steam coming up out of his collar. Yeah.
As we had with each other, the relationship, our personal relationships with Prabhupada were always very, very humorous. As well as being very serious. I think the fact is that what we're seeing, what I see here today, and all the last few days, bears testimony to the serious perfection of Prabhupada's teachings. There's no doubt whatever he set out to do has been done more than we could ever have expected. And I think it's just, like I said the other night, I think it's just beginning. If we pass through a transitional stage of sorts, I miss most of that period. It was rather unpleasant, a lot of things. But I'm convinced that, by following the four basic principles that Prabhupada set down, the regulative principles, and what he's written in his books for us to follow and understand, is all we ever need. There's nothing else needed. There's been some controversy of late that Prabhupada never took his devotees into the higher levels of transcendental realization. But Prabhupada always said, he was dealing basically with simpletons, first graders, that as we qualify for these levels of understanding of Krishna, Krishna will reveal them to us. We don't need anything more than what Prabhupada has given us. It's the simplest, most beautiful system there is, chant Hare Krishna. That's proven. Time proven.
One time when we were staying out at John Lennon's, Prabhupada sent me in to make a bank deposit for him. And he wrote a letter to the manager of Lloyd's Bank, where he had his own book trust account, that my secretary, Mr. Michael Grant, will be depositing £25 in my account. So I left feeling very elated that I was Prabhupada's secretary, and I was going to be making a deposit in Prabhupada's bank account. And so I was just kind of riding in on a cloud on the bus into central London, Long Acre Branch, Lloyd's Bank, all the way from Tittenhurst to make this £25 deposit. And so I made the deposit, and I gave him the passport and the stamp, and I brought it back to Prabhupada. Late in the afternoon, I got back. And I gave it to him, and the bank book, and I said, oh, I made the deposit for him. I said, okay. And he said, and you have the receipt? And I said, no, they didn't give me a receipt. And he said, they did not give you a receipt? And I said, no. But they stamped the passport. They stamped the amount and the date. But they did not give you a receipt? No. So why did they not give you a receipt? Maybe they're not very well managed. Said, no, that is not the reason. Why did they not give you a receipt? And I said, I didn't ask them for one. No, that is not the reason. Tell me, why did they not give you a receipt? And I was just racking my brain. I couldn't think of it. I sort of tried to make an offer that it wasn't the teller had forgotten. He just lost his mind and became absent-minded. No, no, that wasn't the reason. Why didn't they give you a receipt? So and then I was completely at a loss. I said, I don't know about that. And then he just looked out the window kind of wistfully for a long time, didn't say anything. And then he started to talk about what Calcutta was like in the early 1900s. And he went on and on and on, telling about how when the British people first came to India, they sent their best men, the viceroys, very handsome, well-educated, well-behaved people, and everybody liked them so much. And they were like us, our own parents. And he went on and on, and he began to trace the whole history of British India. And then he began to explain how some of them got greedy, some of them committed some atrocities against the Indians, and then gradually, how one thing led to another. And finally there was open rebellion and India became independent. And during this time he said something to the effect that the sun never set in the British Empire, now it never rises in the British Empire. And he then talked about the World War II, and he said there was a picture of in the newspaper, a cartoon of a lion in a hospital bed in tractions, all bandaged from head to foot. And, the arms and legs held up from the ceiling in these tractions. And this was the British lion after World War II. And when he told about this, he laughed and laughed. And then he just went on to say how degraded everything had become, how he read about England in the early days, and now everything was so small and it was so dirty, and everything was sinful and people were falling down. And the culmination of all this was that Lloyd's Bank, the bank of record for the whole world, could not even give a receipt for £25. His whole dissertation took about 45 minutes. I was just spellbound listening to all this history. It was amazing.
There was never a person that approached Prabhupada. We've brought some of the most highly intellectual people in the world to meet Prabhupada, both in this room or In other places, we would take him to their places. Yeah, but okay. But wherever he went, no matter who was there, whether they were aggressively angry or challenging or intelligent mathematicians or scientists, Prabhupada knew everything. He knew the answer to every question they could ask. He could beat them in every argument they could give without any exception. In all the years that Mukunda and I were with him, we never saw him make any fault, any error in that respect. We were talking earlier, I don't know if it's been published, or I know I taped this particular conversation. I don't know if it's been distributed, the conversation between Prabhupada and a famous British historian named Arnold Toynbee. Has anybody ever seen that conversation? Oh, it has been. It has been published. Ah, good. But he didn't go over. Well, what it's, I remember most from the conversation, I'd studied Toynbee myself in college. He was the world's foremost authority on the Greek civilization. And he began immediately likening the Greek civilization to the present situation of the Americans and the Russians. That the Americans were the Athenian Empire, and the Russians were the Spartan Empire. And Prabhupada said, yes, just see, today Athens is a thriving city and Sparta is dead. And they both agreed right away that Russia could not hold, that you cannot run a state on Spartan principles and have it exist long. And he told Prabhupada that, in his estimation, that the every great civilization, like the Athenian civilization, develops one form of art form in particular to express itself, and that Greece had developed and perfected the plastic art form, the statuary, and that the modern or equivalent Athenian, which is the American civilization, has developed as its form of expression the art of sound vibration. Prabhupada agreed immediately, yes, and the perfection of that sound vibration is the Hare Krishna mantra. And they got along just like that. They both agreed on everything each other said in the whole conversation. It's wonderful. Those kinds of conversations stimulated Prabhupada more than anything. I mean, in this very room have sat, gosh, who all have we had? We had Graham Hill, the famous... Did he? Yeah, I'm sure he probably did. I don't remember. You know, I tried to tape all of those. I think most of them survived. But I'm trying to remember. I remember with the Graham Hill conversation, they got right away into death, talking about death, because Prabhupada was curious to see what a man who drove 250 miles an hour around a racetrack thought about death.
Actually, what happened was he was there with his whole family, wife and children.
He talked most of the, I was here also, the beginning of the conversation was Graham talking, and many of you may know that he died in a very tragic plane crash right here in Elf Street. His plane was coming in at night and it crashed. So this was not very long before that, and he said that he participated in many races, and I think he'd had actually a bad accident once and recovered from it. He talked about a number of the races that he'd been in how he'd won this one and he was going to be in that one. So after speaking for a long time, Prabhupada looked at him and he said, yes, but there is another race. That is the race with death. And then from that point he started speaking, and we were thinking, wow, this is really heavy, you know. And Prabhupada began to explain about, you know, dehino sminjata dehaya, you're not the body. And it wasn't so long after that this horrible plane crash took place. But who else came? It was Schumacher, who wrote The Small is Beautiful. Alistair Hardy, Fenner Brockway, Donovan, there's some others. Satish Kumar. There was a Queensberry, Marquis de Queensberry, or Lord Queensberry. He came once. He was someone from the House of Lords. Yeah. I don't know. He was an environmentalist. Sarva? Who? I wasn't here for that one. I wasn't here. Well, some media people that came here, there was someone from the Observer, Colin somebody, who wrote a big piece of Prabhupada, and there was a fellow named Mike Robinson that was written about in London Broadcasting Company. Not while I was there.
So much, and it was actually selfish on our part, because we knew that as long as we kept these kind of people coming here, Prabhupada would stay here, and we tried to keep him here as long as we could. I mean, we pulled all kinds of tricks to keep Prabhupada here. He'd get a letter from Bombay or someplace, and he'd call us and say, "Shyam Sundar, I'm thinking to go to Bombay next week. You know, they really want me to go down there for some whatever it was." So then I'd run out and get together. How can we get this postponed? And we were pretty successful at it. We kept them here longer than most places could. But it wasn't our doing. Prabhupada liked it here. He liked it very much. Part who? I was asking you that. I don't remember. Might have come. I don't remember. I used to go to his place.
One of the most interesting things about Prabhupada was that even though we were here with him at darshan,
with the devotees, he'd visit the deities, he'd be doing his dictating and letter writing, and he'd be preaching to these famous people and meeting with devotees at night, and just talking sometimes philosophically, bouncing ideas off people. He was at the same time managing a global movement very meticulously. He would write 10 to 15 letters a day, and they weren't just letters to encourage people. They were letters that made very difficult decisions for people that didn't know what to do or how to say things or really literally know what to do. And it was in dozens and dozens of countries. His mind was thinking about all these things at the same time. And yet he appeared completely relaxed. You could walk into his room, even in New York, and it would be like a rural environment, rural setting. It was so relaxing. And it gives a glimpse of how it was possible for someone like Vyasadeva to compile all these incredible Vedic literatures. Prabhupada was not only doing all these things, but he was writing the books of knowledge for the next 10,000 worlds, next 10,000 years, as he said, his spiritual ecstasy. He's writing perfect scripture and then managing a whole worldwide movement. And wherever he was, everyone was kind of thinking he's mainly here, concentrating on how to preach in this area. Well, first one thing that happened was there was a group here with Koshika. I think Shyam Sundar might have been here, but he said something about, now we'll call it Bhaktivedanta Manor, Prabhupada said. And Koshika said, but it's Pickett's Manor. We'll have to make an application. We can't just change the name. He said, you just call it Bhaktivedanta Manor, and the name will change. Everyone will start calling it Bhaktivedanta Manor. The postman will call it Bhaktivedanta Manor, the neighbors will call it Bhaktivedanta Manor, you will call it Bhaktivedanta Manor, it will become Bhaktivedanta Manor. Then, after that, someone, I don't remember who it might have been, Malati, but I'm not sure, said that Prabhupada also said it should be called Gokula Vrindavan. You know, like sort of a generic name. This is the manor, the building, but the whole thing was Gokula Vrindavan. So on the basis of that, I proceeded to publish a little pamphlet. It said, Welcome to Gokul. Well, the one I remember was a green sort of fold-over pamphlet thing with directions on it. There may have been a letterhead, too. But it said, Welcome to Gokul Vrindavan, da-da-da, and it's like this, and it's like that. And then it had some little pictures on it. So we sent it off to Prabhupada, thinking, oh, it's still like this. So then a telegram came from Prabhupada, saying, stop printing pamphlet immediately. Pamphlet, most objectionable, stop printing immediately. I thought, oh, no, what have I done? And we waited, and it said, letter follows. So we waited and waited. It seemed like years, about a week, for this letter to come. What was wrong? We were going over and over it. What was wrong? And so Prabhupada, in the letter, said that you have made a picture of a cow's head without the cow's body. Somehow a little picture of a cow to show the cow pattern. And he said, this means slaughterhouse. You must stop printing this immediately. Huh? Don't you know? Something like that. And this is in the days whenever a letter came from Prabhupada, everybody clustered around, you know. So we were all reading this together. And then underneath that it said, and also I have told you that this place should be called Bhaktivedanta Manor, not Gokula Vrindavan. And that was it. You know, that was the end of that that little controversy. But, yeah, Prabhupada didn't like that at all. In London? Did he do in London? When? Not that first period, though. Oh, well, just the time when he first came. The late night lineup, he was on that. That's right. That was the most famous one. I don't know who it was, but one thing that was, yeah, the most significant thing about that, that's the only one I remember that he did when in that first period. Oh, there's another one. 1972. But in 1969, I think he only did one. It was the late night lineup. And we all sat on the floor, about five or six devotees. And he went around and sat on the floor. And actually what happened was our tilaks were all kind of worn off, and the makeup people said, what's that? Why is that mark on your head? Some of it are worn off and some of them aren't. So we didn't know, and nobody brought any tilak. This was television, but nobody thought of it. So he said, so the makeup people said, would you mind if we painted it on you? All right. So then they all took us into this little green dressing room, and it looked like barber chairs, and they sat us down and with a little brush painted these perfect white tilaks on. With some kind of real acrylic stuff. It took days to get off. Couldn't get that stuff off. It was in there for good. So he interviewed each person and, you know, just kind of held the microphone, very respectful. Then he came to Prabhupada and asked him a lot of questions. And then at one point he said, do you have a concept of hell in your religion? And Prabhupada said, this is hell. Ever since I've been here, it's been raining. I haven't seen the sun. It's moist. It's damp. It's humid. This is hell. And he just lost his composure and lost a few beats, and he it was like he was paralyzed. He couldn't say anything. And then Prabhupada sensing this immediately jumped into his rescue and said, of course it is a great tribute to the British people that they have built such a great civilization in this climate. And he said, yes, yes. Yes, that's true, that's right. And then he continued, you know, he completely regained his composure. That was a real highlight. They all brought us down. It was live about 11 o'clock at night on the BBC, and a lot of people saw it. It was an amazing display of Prabhupada's kindness, because he knew that this man had completely lost it, and he saved it. Huh. Really? Right, we're all in little cushions on the floor, same level.
Then when Prabhupada, everything was perfect, he started to understand everything.
On now because of the wrinkles. Can't get it right, you know. Industry in Britain was so heavily controlled, and at least in those days, you know, all there was BBC. There wasn't that many radio and television programs like there would have been in the States, but a tremendous amount of newspaper coverage. It seems like there was always a reporter hanging around the temple in those days. Marvelous collection you have there. It's great. Make sure all those things we passed out get back to the papers, get back to them. Now, the first, this is kind of interesting because of the difference between England and America, much more controlled. The first Harinam, we went up to Trafalgar Square and thought, well, just go where the people are and start chanting. So we started a fairly vigorous, uproarious kirtan right near the Nelson's Column. And this clutch of policemen started a huddle about 10 feet away from us. And it grew to about 15, 20, 25, and they were looking over it kind of furtively and then talking and looking. Finally, one of them came over. He was the mandated representative to inform us. And he said, who's in charge here? And we all kind of pointed at each other. Kathy Gurudas said, I have to inform you that if you continue to play these musical instruments in this monument, we'll have to arrest you. Oh, well, can we sing without playing the instruments? He said, well, you can, but I don't think you want to do that. So anyway, we chanted for a little while, and it wasn't, you know, not very many people came. So then we decided to try another venue. So we went over to Soho Street. In fact, we went to Soho Square. And by that time, it was drizzling, and we were kind of dampened in our spirits also, because we only got about maybe a couple of minutes in at Trafalgar Square, and a lot of people had come to hear us, but the police had stopped us. So by the time we got to Soho Square, and it was raining much harder, there was nobody around. I mean, there was nobody in the square. We just thought, all right, we're here. We got our kartals and we got our mridanga. And I remember you were wearing a bright blue Nehru coat, and we had all our vet dhotis on, pressed, and the women had their saris. And so we just started in, you know, and nobody came. Nobody said a word. Nobody watched. Nobody stopped. There was no one in sight. Finally, this one kind of maybe 50-year-old bespectacled man with a bowler hat and a little briefcase and umbrella, you know, like they carry, and he had his umbrella up. He just stopped and started watching us. That was our first captive audience. You know, we said, Hare Krishna, so for about 10 or 15 minutes, he just stood there like a statue. And finally, it was just getting so that we had to stop. And but he didn't come over to us. So I think you and I, or you and Gurudas and I, walked over to him and said hello, and
he just had this kind of incredible look on his face, you know, this quizzical look, and he finally said, "What's it an eye of?" We couldn't even understand what he was saying because of his accent. "What's it an eye of?" That was our first Hari Nam customer.
Bhagavad Gita even printed yet to pass out or sell on the street.
Yeah.
We had to print up with little pamphlets. And they didn't even have Xerox machines, did they? We had those mimeograph deals, Gestetner machines, to pass out any information. So there was, you know, our preaching, our level of preaching was different. Maybe we didn't have literature to give people.
And then gradually Prabhupada, in his sense, so we started to get the Dr. Godhead magazines. And I think one of the first successful kirtans we had was in Chelsea. And the police didn't stop us. I mean, they would just kind of tell us to back off the footpath a little bit. And we chanted for an hour or so and started handing out the magazines. And a lot of people gathered around. So it was just a matter of kind of being a Sankirtan guerrilla, finding the right place.